This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, brought to you by WordCast Productions. To learn how your company can take advantage of podcasting to reach new audiences, contact us through wordcast.biz. On September 16th, the Charlottesville Albemarle Democratic Breakfast featured a discussion on the implications of the Marshall Newman Marriage Amendment.
All right, good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this month's Charlottesville Albemarle Democratic Breakfast. My name is Nick Lang. I'm the Jack Jewett District Chair for the Albemarle County Democrats, and I'm here in place of my chair, Fred Hudson, who's asked me to be here. And we're here to talk about an issue which I would call the Marshall Newman Anti-Marriage Amendment. Normally, the Steering Committee of the County Democratic Party doesn't take positions on important issues, leaving that to the candidates we're supporting. But we felt strongly enough about this one that we did at a recent meeting pass a resolution in opposition to this amendment. And I thought we wanted you to know that. Well, let us move to our program for today. I would like to introduce the moderator of our panel. And she is Catherine McNamara. She's the editor and publisher of archipelago.org, for which she writes endnotes. And she's the author of Narrow Road to the Deep North, Journey into the Interior of Alaska. It's a nonfiction narrative. With support from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, she has lectured in Virginia public libraries about the situation in publishing and the constitutional implications of the USA Patriot Act for free speech and privacy. In the spring of 2002, Archipelago published Senator Russell Feingold's speech explaining why he had opposed the USA Patriot Act. Institutional Memory, a series of conversations she conducted between 1997 and 2002 with distinguished book people, can be read on archipelago.org. Professor McNamara has lectured and read at University College Dublin, Cambridge University, and the University of Trier, Germany. Her nonfiction essays and reviews have appeared in journals, anthologies, and newspapers, and her poetry collected in several anthologies. She's received grants from the Government of France, the Alaska Arts Council, and the Alaska Humanities Forum, the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and Public Policy, and the Scottish Gaelic Arts Agency. She's presently a fellow at the university, at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, and she is working on a book about the Dena'ina Nation. Athabascan writer Peter Kalifornsky. I'll give you Professor McNamara.
Thank you. I am not a professor, although I might say I am on more than one occasion an advocate. This is an important topic, as you know, because it in a certain sense, wants to redefine and reorganize a very great deal of our communal life and our social policy. It has implications, some of which we can foresee, but many, many of which can't yet be anticipated, and that's always a very dangerous matter when a constitutional amendment is proposed, as our topic today is about a proposed constitutional amendment. I'll say briefly how we're going to do this, and then I will actually read to you the Marshall Newman Amendment. I guess that's the easiest thing to call it. I think Mark Usry made available copies of it as well. We have a fine panel today. Mark Usry, I'll name them all and then introduce each. Mark Usry, Claire Kaplan, Ann Coughlin, and David Toscano as well, our delegate, who will add something at the end. Each of the panelists will speak from here for about 10 minutes to the topic in terms of his or her interest and expertise. And then we'll open, and then David will speak about the legislative history of this because it is also an aspect we need to know to give us more context. And then we'll open the floor to your questions. And I'll handle that part. The panelists will then stand, sit at the table, and I hope you can all see and hear, but they'll stand here to give their talks. Mark Usry is a professor of business law at JMU, where he has been on the faculty since 1987. A former practicing attorney, Mark Usry is a veteran of a number of campaigns and active in civic work. He is a member of the Board of Equality Virginia and president of Citizens for Central Park of Cape Charles, Virginia. Mark Usry lives in Charlottesville with two children and his partner of 11 years. Claire Kaplan, director of Sexual and Domestic Violence Services at the University of Virginia Women's Center since 1991, has been a community and national activist in the feminist, anti-violence, democratic socialist, and LGBT rights movements for many years. Originally from Southern California, her first public political act was at the age of 15 when she picketed Ralph's grocery store with her seven-year-old sister on behalf of the United Farm Workers. In later years, she worked in the film industry before joining the staff of the Los Angeles Commission on Assault Against Women and then the National Coalition Against Sexual Assault in Washington, D.C. In addition to numerous articles, Claire Kaplan has contributed to the anthology called Toward Acceptance, Sexual Orientation on Campus, edited by Evans and Wall, and contributed to the Handbook for University and College Women's Centers. She served on the board of directors of the Virginians Aligned Against Sexual Assault and is an active member of its successor organization, the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance. Since 1991, she's been a leader of UVA Pride, that is UVA's LGBT faculty, staff, and graduate student association, and is active on grounds in working to ensure that the university is a fair and safe place for all students. Claire Kaplan received her BS from UC Davis, her master's degree in professional writing from the University of Southern California, and her PhD at the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education. Her first act as a member of the Democratic Party was to work on George McGovern's presidential campaign. Despite numerous setbacks, she says, she hasn't switched parties yet. Anne M. Coughlin joined the faculty of the University of Virginia Law School in 1996 after visiting through the 1995-96 academic year. Her primary research and teaching interests are in the areas of criminal law, criminal procedure, and feminist jurisprudence. She taught at Vanderbilt Law School from 1991 to 1995. As a law student, Anne Coughlin served as managing editor for the New York University Law Review and was elected Phi Beta Kappa and to the Order of the Coif. After graduating, she clerked for Judge John O. Newman of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and for Justice Louis F. Powell, Jr. of the Supreme Court of the United States. Notably, during the time when Bowers Hardwick was decided, for which Powell voted and later regretted his vote. And at a certain point, it might be worth raising that question in the question time. She then practiced as an associate with Cravath, Swain, and Moore in New York and Miller, Cassidy, LaRocca, and Lewin in Washington, D.C. I also, if you need more information, there's a good deal about this Marshall Newman proposed amendment on the web. You can Google it and find some worthwhile sites, but I'd suggest one called Anonymous is a Woman, a website, a blog about politics, religion, the economy, the culture, and wars, you know, all the fun stuff, she says. But it's a good blog. It's a thoughtful blog. The Log Cabin Republicans also seem to be opposed to this amendment, and they have a site worth reading. And that's virginialogcabin.org, but you can Google them as well. And the Commonwealth Coalition, which has a marvelous site and has excerpts from newspapers and editorials about this, links to other sites. That's the Commonwealth Coalition, and for some reason I don't have the URL, but I think you can Google it and find it easily in case you need more to read.
VoteNoVA.org.
Right, we'll give the specific information about this. Okay. This is how the proposed amendment, on which we presumably all will vote no in November, reads. Okay. That only a union between one man and one woman may be a marriage valid in or recognized by this Commonwealth and its political subdivisions. This Commonwealth and its political subdivisions shall not create or recognize a legal status for relationships of unmarried individuals that intends to approximate the design, quality, significance, or effects of marriage. Nor shall this Commonwealth or its political subdivisions create or recognize another union, partnership, or other legal status to which is assigned the rights, benefits, obligations, qualities, or effects of marriage. It's breathtaking in its vagueness. We will never have clarity from this language. It opens up huge areas of social, political, constitutional, and all subsets of legal matters that bind us together as a society. Some of the specific questions it raises are questions of the elderly. How will people who live by themselves form practical relationships with others that in some way resemble what seems to be implied, although not directly, by whatever marriage may mean according to this this proposed amendment? It affects, it's meant directly to be against gay coupledom, but it also affects heterosexual couples, especially those who decide not to marry, but who prefer to live together. It raises First Amendment and Establishment Clauses because it proposes, because it proposes to define marriage, but of course it doesn't define marriage. It leaves us with the implication that we know what marriage is. A union between one man and one woman, but what comes of that? Is it to be children? Is that the definition? Is that biological lineage becomes the basis of what a marriage is? Is it sex on demand? Is it a contractual relationship about money and will and the rights of visitation? We have opened, or the Republicans who favor this have opened, a whole discussion about the nature of our social contract with each other. And so to speak to various aspects of this, I'll give you first Mark Usry.
Thank you very much. I wanted to point out a couple of things that that I have with me, plenty of the brochures. Feel free to take as many as you would like to pass on to other folks. They're here at the front, and there's a whole box, and that's what they're here for. Another couple of things that I will mention is that there is a great op-ed piece that Julian Bond wrote about civil rights and this amendment. It's a wonderful op-ed piece. I am going to be passing around this sheet. If you are willing to say that you'll vote no in November, we'd love to have your name here. We won't sell this list to anybody else, promise. If you want to volunteer in some way on this effort, please indicate so. And if you want me to send you copies of the articles I'm mentioning, simply place a check mark here, and I'll be happy to do that. And again, no one else gets these lists except the Vote for the Commonwealth Coalition. So there's the op-ed piece by Julian Bond, which is wonderful. There's also an opinion by John Sternlicht. John is the general counsel for the Virginia Economic Development Partnership. He's also the former Deputy Secretary of Commerce under Governor Warner, and he's written an article on the economic impact of this amendment and the potential loss of jobs, and certainly the increase in jobs based upon the final enactment allowing private companies in Virginia to authorize domestic partner benefits for their employees. So this is another one of the articles. And finally, excuse me, the last one that I will offer to you, for those who want an alternative opinion to that of our Attorney General, this opinion would be written and endorsed by over 100 attorneys, Democrats and Republicans, and it's an executive summary of the potential legal impact of the amendment if passed. It's a pretty quick read. It's only 3 pages, and again, I'll be happy to send that to you if you indicate that you would like it. Thank you, thank you. All right, that said, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I want to address 4 questions that we seem to hear most often related to this amendment. And the first is, do we think that we can defeat the Marshall-Newman Amendment, the so-called Protection of Marriage Amendment? And the answer is yes, absolutely. The Mason-Dixon poll, which came out, had a smaller sample size and was a much briefer interview than the 18-minute interview that went to almost twice the sample size that the Commonwealth Coalition commissioned about 6 weeks ago. In that coalition poll, we found 45% of Virginians voting yes, and 4% of those was a soft yes. We discovered that when people hear the second paragraph, their support drops. So we've got the ability, we've got less than half of those polled saying that they're going to vote yes on the amendment. Number two, the political climate in Virginia is much different 2 years later than the 2004 election cycle, which saw a large number of these types of amendments passed. In fact, if you really want to hone in on how different it is, ask Dick Black, who we were able to help defeat in his reelection bid. The third is that there is an awful lot of passion and involvement from a number of different groups. The Commonwealth Coalition has over 100 different groups that are part of that coalition, and there are any number of different reasons why people should vote no. All right, so why would the Marshall-Newman Amendment be more harmful than the current state law, House Bill 751, which the state legislature gave to us a couple of years ago? There's several reasons. For one thing, this amendment restricts the rights of marriage for not only gay couples, but straight couples. There are 130,000 unmarried couples in the state of Virginia. 89% are straight. Had an interesting discussion this summer with my mother-in-law, and I guess she isn't technically my mother-in-law. It's my partner's mother. But she is currently, as my mother would have said years ago, before she understood the legal ramifications, my mother-in-law is living in sin with her husband. She's 91. But the reality is that she couldn't marry the man because she would lose the Social Security of her former husband, and she couldn't afford to live without it. And so they have formed a partnership. Fortunately for them, they live in Florida part of the year, Canada the other part of the year. But if they lived in Virginia under this proposed amendment, they have a plan for what happens when one of them passes. And if someone in the family was opposed to how they planned it out, it could be challenged under this amendment. Even though I don't see that happening in the family at this point in time. So number one is the impact on all unmarried couples. Number two is the heightened awareness. House Bill 751 primarily dealt with gay couples. But now we've got a lot more people aware of the potential to challenge arrangements of unmarried individuals than we had under House Bill 751. Defense attorneys are already saying that it would be malpractice on their part not to mention this amendment and use this amendment in their defense of domestic violence defendants based upon the situation in Ohio. Proponents of this amendment would no doubt follow the lead of other states where proponents of those amendments that passed then immediately filed lawsuits challenging domestic partner benefits for public employees, domestic partner benefits of private companies. If proponents of the amendment really were concerned about marriage, perhaps what they should focus on would be personal finance courses in every high school, parenting courses in every high school, and conflict resolution courses in every high school, because we know those are the three primary reasons why relationships break up and marriages break up. The true irony of the amendment is that the more purposeful an unmarried couple is in making plans for their lives, then the more potential there is for developing legal agreements that intend, quote-unquote, to approximate, quote-unquote, the benefits, effects, or obligations of marriage. The more thoughtful unmarried couples are in making their plans, the more likely it is that they would be held illegal. One thing that our Attorney General doesn't seem to get, and perhaps he needs to study a little more con law, is that he keeps talking about the laws on the books that protect wills and medical directives and those sorts of things. The reality is, once the Constitution is amended, if a law conflicts with the Constitution is the trump card. But I don't hear him saying that. I'm not sure why, other than he voted for the amendment and is campaigning for the amendment currently. The third question is, why should any of us care? And hopefully I've given you those reasons. 130,000 couples. The uncertainty of what the wording in the amendment could mean. The impact on real families like mine. The impact on the children of real families like mine and many friends of ours. And the 60,000 unmarried domestic violence victims who seek services each year in Virginia. Because if Ohio is any indication, it can happen here as well. What can we do? Number one is talk to folks. A lot of people simply don't understand the impact. Sign up and let us know if you can help in the effort or if you want more information. Take as many of these brochures as you will to pass out to friends and neighbors, and definitely vote no in November. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer questions when that time's appropriate. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here to speak to you about this issue. And I have my feet in two pies here because I'm involved in the Commonwealth Coalition in my involvement as a lesbian, as a person who's a partner of 18 years and a daughter. But I'm really here to speak on behalf of those of us who work in the anti-violence movement. One of the key partners in the Commonwealth Coalition is the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance, which has come out publicly against this amendment. Rarely does the organization take a stand on legislation of this type, and certainly can't endorse candidates. But we feel so strongly about it that we are roaring out there to try to defeat this amendment, because it will have a terrible impact on victims of domestic violence. There are cards on your table which go into some detail about that. And I'll give you a little bit of brief history, because some of you probably were involved in this, but the history of legislation regarding domestic violence in Virginia is a little hit and miss, at least at the beginning. And the first civil protective orders were established by the Commonwealth in 1984, and it took 3 years to allow law enforcement to enforce it. So they just put it on the books and then didn't do anything about it. Then you have to fast forward to 1991. when then Attorney General Mary Sue Terry established a task force to really look at domestic violence laws, its enforcement in the Commonwealth, and what we can do to make to improve the conditions for victims. And as a result of that task force, a whole lot of change happened. But you can see how long it took just to get to that point. One is establishment of emergency protective orders, a new and more powerful remedy if the violence continues by making it Class 6 felony to violate a protective order on the third offense, that allows law enforcement to transport someone to a shelter or some safe place if they need that. They changed the term spouse abuse to family abuse, so that included the children and other members of the family. And they expanded the individuals who are eligible for that protection, so that included step family members, to people living in the house, and people who had a child in common. And then and they expanded that to a point where it could include any unmarried people. So it was 1991 when unmarried partners were protected or covered under domestic violence laws in Virginia. So now we have sort of these family abuse protective orders, which has been very helpful and is actually a very effective tool, and protections for family members who are not necessarily married. It could be also protection of parents, because when a batterer abuses a partner, they threaten everyone. They can threaten in-laws, they can threaten cousins, they can threaten anyone who's remotely related or even friends. And so it's all these people can be protected through protective orders. There have been other changes as well over the years that have strengthened enforcement and protections for victims of domestic violence. But the key piece in the history is this task force and its recommendations in 1991. So now we have this so-called marriage amendment. And we have the clause that was mentioned, which is that second piece, talking about all the sort of vague and rights of marriage, of which there are more than 1,000. And how would this impact victims of domestic violence? Well, first of all, it removes the whole notion of a family or household member. Let me go back to the spouse issue. So the protections that are in existence right now are high-level law enforcement response that includes warrantless arrest, issuance of an emergency protective order, transportation to hospitals and shelters, written and oral information on victims' rights and services, and a copy of arrest report can go to the victim. There are increased criminal penalties for repeat offenses and access to family violence protective orders. So if this constitutional amendment passes, all that's wiped off the books. I should also mention that in 1994, Jim Gilmore, then Attorney General, was asked, what about same-sex couples? Are they protected under these domestic violence laws? And he said no. And he referred to the definition of cohabit in Black's Law Dictionary, which I understand is sort of like the first-year law student's law dictionary. That's what he used, our attorney general, sort of the middle school version of law. And so he relied on that for his definition of cohabit. Luckily, the attorney general's opinion isn't binding, so there are certain localities that ignored that. Luckily, in Charlottesville, that's the case. But that's not true in a lot of Virginia. So at this present time, the majority of Virginia courts don't consider same-sex domestic violence family abuse. Same-sex victims have not been allowed to file for family abuse protective orders in most courts, and law enforcement officers in most jurisdictions do not respond to same-sex domestic violence according to the same protocols that apply to other cases. So we've gone forward a little bit, and we've stepped back a little bit. So this sort of gives you a clue about why we're so worried, but there's another reason why we're worried about this. We look to Ohio as an example. Ohio has a constitutional amendment that is word for word, practically, identical to the one that is proposed for Virginia. In addition, their domestic violence laws are very similar to ours, though I would say a little stronger, and they were on the ball way before we were. They included unmarried partners in 1979, so they were way ahead of the game. So despite the fact that Ohio has actually been really on the front lines of domestic violence legislation, what's happening now is this. Defense attorneys have won dismissals of domestic violence cases at trial, arguing that unmarried domestic violence victims, and these are heterosexual victims, are no longer eligible for protective orders And abusers cannot be charged with domestic violence. And most victims are not represented in court. They don't know that they can appeal this. And, of course, they couldn't afford to, even if they knew. Unmarried victims wanting to bring domestic abuse cases or petition for protective orders are being turned away by local prosecutors and local courts before their cases are even being heard. 8 of the 12 Ohio courts of appeal have reviewed lower court decisions in domestic violence cases, and 6 have ruled that the Ohio amendment does not prohibit prosecution of domestic violence abuse against unmarried partners, but 2 have ruled that it does. So now it's going up to the Supreme Court. So what this means is, because there's got to be more judicial opinions and more appeals, et cetera, in the meanwhile, victims are being held in suspension, and they're not being protected. They've been in legal limbo since 2004 when their amendment passed, and they won't know for at least another year. So there are people who are being turned away, who are in great danger. So how would this play out in Virginia? I have a different number of unmarried couples. I have 137,000 unmarried couples in Virginia. over 55% of victims of domestic violence programs are not married to their abusers, who seek assistance from domestic violence programs. So more than half. In 2003, 40,000 protective orders available only in family abuse cases were issued in Virginia. And that same year, the Virginia Office of the Chief Medical Examiner reported that of intimate partner homicides, 57% of victims were killed by a current or ex-boyfriend or girlfriend. They weren't married to the person who killed them. Domestic violence, I have a frog in my throat today. Defense attorneys in Virginia are already telling the Alliance that if the proposed amendment passes, they will make the same arguments used in Ohio to get their clients' charges dropped or pled down. As in Ohio, appeals in such cases can take years before a final ruling is made, potentially leaving hundreds of thousands of Virginians without safety in the interim. Already, the shelter programs are looking at their shelter capacity to determine if they have the space to allow victims to stay longer in the shelter when they don't have access to protective orders. And businesses need to be considering what to do when an employee is being battered by her boyfriend but can't get a protective order, which usually includes the workplace, and that prohibits the abuser from coming there. Thank you. So they won't have any protection there either. One of the findings made by judges in Ohio is that if voters knew about the possible consequences to domestic violence victims but voted in support of the amendment anyway, they must not have cared about the impact of domestic violence on victims. This is from Judge Moore from the Cleveland Municipal Court. He said, fundamental changes to the amendment in general and domestic violence statute in particular should have been contemplated. These dangers were known or should have been known before the initiative was passed in November. And I have found in my conversations with people who are a little squeamish about the idea of same-sex marriage are absolutely, absolutely clear about supporting victims of domestic violence. If you encounter someone who's not quite sure or a little uncomfortable with the marriage issue, you can always say, you know, use this argument. And that's the Commonwealth Coalition, in fact, considers this argument, protecting domestic violence victims, to be the one that will reach the most people in convincing them to vote no. Thank you.
Good morning, and thanks so much for coming and for inviting me to participate. It's a real honor and a joy to be here. I wanted to follow up briefly on one of Mark Ussery's questions and sort of comments. Why should we care? Why should we care about this proposed amendment? And I guess I want to just say bluntly that I think we should care because it's illiberal in the philosophical sense. This is illiberal, and it's also wrong to include in our Constitution this clear statement of bias against gay couples and gay intimate associations. And so that's going to kind of be my bottom line, though, of course, I agree there are a lot of the amendment means a lot of other things and is going to have implications for a lot of other folks, including straight folks. Nonetheless, I see it as being very clearly a statement of bias. I'm going to talk to you very briefly about some of the federal constitutional law aspects, which, of course, are somewhat remote from us today, but ultimately could be very important. And the first thing I just wanted to say very briefly, I'm sure you've been following the op-eds and so forth, and many of them have commented on some of the federal constitutional questions as well. But think about the story of constitutional law in our country. It has been a fitful story. There have been stops and starts and so forth. But I think today it's fair for us to look back and to conclude strongly that it's been the story of evolving extensions of rights. So we have seen a consensus over time that we should continue to recognize rights to equal respect, equal treatment, also precious privacy rights, the idea that we should have rights of privacy and autonomy in our intimate association. And what we've seen over time, again, with fits and starts, is the extension, not the retraction of these rights. And so to my view, as a law professor and a student of constitutional law, there's just a terrible irony that the state may be poised to include this language in our Bill of Rights. This is a provision that's designed to strip people of their rights and to disable this generation and to tie the hands of future generations and to prevent them from coming up with a new consensus about what the rights should be. Mark particularly has mentioned, and Claire as well, that the amendment is written in very broad and sweeping language. It's very ambiguous. That second paragraph, it's a lawyer's field day. So part of me goes, wow, this will make tons of work for folks in my profession. People will spend a lot of time trying to figure out what this language means. And that, of course, is a completely ridiculous way to proceed with constitutional lawmaking. The last thing you want to do is to create lots of very difficult constitutional questions for courts. But clearly this has a very direct and immediate impact on people's lives. So if you look at the amendment itself, it doesn't take a lawyer to point to the ambiguous language and to identify what some of the tough questions are going to be. And so many of us around the law school, when we're asked, what does the amendment mean, we say, we don't know. We have no idea what it means. It's going to take a case-by-case reckoning of people trying to make private arrangements, enter into contracts, partnerships, unions, call it what it will, employers extending benefits to unmarried partners, to gay unions, and so forth. And then all of this will have to be litigated on a case-by-case basis. So what most of us say, we don't know what it means. So I was somewhat anxious when I got the invitation to come here today and tell you what it means. We don't know what it means. But one thing that we do know it means, I realize that David Toscano was going to speak to the legislative history, and that's something that will ultimately need to be litigated as well. As I read this amendment, whatever it means, it's clearly designed to prevent gay marriage. It may end up preventing a whole lot of other things, but it's clearly designed to prevent gay marriage. The other thing that you can tell from looking at the amendment, and it's here that I'm going to segue into my very brief comments on potential federal constitutional problems, is that, it's written in such vague and sweeping language that it's as if it's trying to say, look, we don't just want to prevent gay marriage, we want to prevent anything. Any rights for gay people that are along the lines of the rights, responsibilities, and obligations that we accord to married couples. So it's clearly, because of the vague language, I say a statement of bias. You don't need, if your objective is to prevent gay marriage and to protect that traditional union, the first sentence would suffice. The second sentence, again, with this clear overreaching, it's plainly a statement of bias. I emphasize that point because that point would matter if this case ever got into a federal court or into a state court for that matter. I'm not sure the Virginia courts, but into a state court that was inclined to be thoughtful about the federal constitutional questions. The court will be suspicious of that second paragraph. The Supreme Court or some of the members of the court will be suspicious of that second paragraph to the extent it looks like a statement of bias. And here I want you to think about two contemporary cases. One, of course, is Lawrence against Texas, and the other is Romer versus Evans. Lawrence against Texas is the case that struck down the criminal sodomy laws. You'll recall that case. It's fairly recent and very important. The court decides on due process, substantive due process grounds, to strike down the criminalization of sodomy. And then Romer is a case in which the court, it's a very peculiar opinion, but the court struck down an amendment to the Colorado Constitution that would have prohibited any government action to protect gay persons. So if you put those two cases together, you can in fact see a blueprint for arguing clearly that our proposed amendment is unconstitutional. You alluded to establishment of religion problems, First Amendment problems, and I agree that there is an establishment problem here. It's not one that the court would recognize. I don't think that the court would view this as violating the Establishment Clause, but to the extent we're able to conclude that this is a definition of marriage that comes to us from a biblical tradition, that would be a problem. Also, to the extent it's designed to prevent associations between people, that would be a First Amendment problem. But the real core issues here go to equal protection and substantive due process protection of privacy rights. And the question for us, and this is an open question in the Supreme Court, is the United States Supreme Court going to extend to gay people the same rights to equality that we've extended to everybody else? And they may be poised to do that. Think of the Lawrence case. In Lawrence, the justices conclude that the right to liberty that is protected in the Due Process Clause includes a right to have sex without being punished as a criminal. But the court's very clear that this right to sex that it's identifying is not merely the right to have sex, but is the right to form an intimate association with the people you choose. So the court says, look, we're not just here talking about a right to homosexual sodomy. We're talking about people's rights to select the most intimate associations for themselves. The government doesn't get to tell you who your intimate associates and partners are. That language is, as we lawyers like to say, dicta. It's broader than is necessary potentially for the holding of the case. But the spirit of the opinion, this is authored by Justice Kennedy, you know, he's not a very, he's kind of a middle-of-the-road guy, is again very protective of the idea that liberty and privacy extends to relationships. You can easily take that language and say that language would, that this amendment would violate that core recognition of the right to privacy. Of course, in the Lawrence opinion, Justice O'Connor, no longer with us on the court, argues that the prohibition on homosexual sodomy is an equal protection violation, that it violates the right of gay people to have sexual relations. And she would have struck it down on that ground. The majority agrees with her. There is an equal protection violation. You can't discriminate based on sexual orientation. But nonetheless, it insists on rooting its opinion in the due process right. The Romer case, what's fascinating to me is that you might be able to read the second paragraph of our proposed ballot amendment as constituting a statement of bias against gay people. It's like, not only are we not going to let you get married, we're not going to let you do anything to protect your private relations. And don't go asking your little cities or villages or hamlets or local councils. Don't ask anybody anytime. You can't get married and you can't have any contractual arrangement that protects you. That sounds, you know, you would argue, similar to this Colorado amendment that prohibited government action to protect gay people from discrimination. So as I read that, I think it's sort of in between, and it's, you know, it's neither fish nor fowl. It's not as narrow as Lawrence, nor as broad as Romer. It's somewhere in between the two. To the extent that we're able to characterize this, and again, I understand it this way. I see it as being a politically expedient statement of desire to harm a politically unpopular group. That is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, and as such, it could be struck down. So In any event, it seems to me that, you know, in part of our case, I realize that I feel like we're living in dangerous times. I feel like we have to make arguments that, obviously, we have to make arguments that appeal to a very broad coalition of groups. We're delighted that the Commonwealth Coalition involves straight people, gay people, people of color, people from a whole umbrella of places, and we need to speak broadly to the impact of this amendment on all of us. But at the same time, I hope that we can pause and recognize that underlying it, I believe, the animus is this bias against gay people that is directly contrary to the way in which we want our constitutional decision-making to proceed. This is the kind of thing, frankly, that should stay in the legislature. Let people duke it out in the political process until we arrive at a new consensus. Don't try to freeze in con law a consensus from, you know, a particular group at a very narrow moment of time. So in my view, this amendment, the good news, if the amendment passes, it's going to be dead. It's going to be dead in... That's the good news. The bad news, it's going to take years to sort it out. There's going to be tons of litigation over what it means on the ground for individual people trying to live their lives, trying to make decisions about what their health benefits should be, how much income they have coming in, and so forth. It's also going to take a lot of time to sort out in terms of the constitutional impact. I spoke to a couple of my colleagues who are true con law scholars. They're not feminists, but they're con law scholars. And they agree that eventually this amendment would be struck down. The question for us is a practical one. Do we have the votes in the court right now? You count the heads. It's very unclear. We may have four. So to the extent that you think of the court as raw political power, again, the good news, this amendment is doomed to fail. Just like every other effort to retract civil rights, to freeze in time and statements of bias. On the other hand, if we pass it, and I urge everyone to get out there and to work against it, it's going to take us a while to get rid of it. And we don't have time to wait. So thank you.
I'd like to call on David Toscano to speak to the legislative history of this, not only the proposed amendment, but the general situation. But may I ask a question to be kept in mind, particularly by David and by Anne, and that is, under what rubric does a state, in fact, have the right to define marriage? As anything more than civil union? Because it seems to me that is a central question here. And if there can be clarity about that, then perhaps some other things will also become clearer to us. David.
Well, thanks very much for the opportunity. Good morning, everyone. It's great to be here. And my view about this is I'm going to stay out of the way and let the expert panel answer these questions. I mostly offered myself to be available in the event that people had questions about the legislative process, because the legislative process, I think folks will point out, because we have at least three lawyers up here, right? They're going to point out how important the legislative history is to interpreting this law. And I just want to make one point in that regard. When the House of Delegates considered the amendment, there were a number of votes that were taken before the final vote on the amendment. Generally speaking, Virginia doesn't have a long history with legislative history, legislative process. They're not elaborate minutes taken of proceedings on the House floor, but there are votes, and those votes are recorded. And there were a series of amendments that were offered on the floor of the House that would have cut the marriage amendment down to size, including one amendment that just defined that would have made the language of the marriage amendment simply that marriage is defined as a union between a man and a woman, period. That amendment was defeated because the House members wanted to go farther than just stating that marriage was between a man and a woman. And that's important because of what Anne was saying. I think she said We don't really know what it means. Well, we know now, given the legislative history, what it doesn't mean. And what it doesn't mean is that marriage is strict, that the definition is strictly between a man and a woman. The amendment goes farther. How much farther is going to be for the courts to determine. So I'm going to step out of the way, and if there's any other questions you have about that process, I'm glad.
And so I'll open up the questions. May I invite the panelists to ask each other questions to start? But the first question is, what does it mean for the state to define marriage, if I can preempt everybody's question?
Apparently it was passed in this direction. The history of the definition of marriage has been by the state. And it has never been a federal issue. It is one of the state's powers that was reserved by the 13 original colonies once they delegated powers to the federal government. So it has been a state by state in the past.
And how is marriage different than civil union?
Good question.
That's actually my real question. Yeah.
As Mark says, it's clearly has always been a state law matter. The federal government does not purport to define marriage, and I take it what we're seeing now, we're living through an era in which people are trying to decide what marriage is. We thought we knew what marriage was, right? It was a word that had well-accepted meaning, and we never explored it. It was part of our received vocabulary. There was no need to define it. So we're living at one of those moments where there's a real struggle between different groups over the meaning of this core term. Clearly, the state's going to have power to decide which marriages it's going to recognize, again, subject to some constitutional constraints. The difference between civil union and marriage, according to some of my students, I teach a feminist theory course, and a gay male student who was on the verge of getting married. That's what he wanted. He wanted to be married. And he said it made a huge difference because, you know, again, I kind of have to laugh because I'm a sort of an old feminist and am skeptical of traditional marriage, therefore. He said for him, the reason that it was so important was that it was the till death do us part. It was that aspect of it, and he wanted that statement from his partner so that if he were on his deathbed, he knew that his partner wouldn't walk away. And it was just a very interesting statement. So, again, the difference between marriage and civil union has to do with the traditional meaning of marriage and the visceral reaction, the cultural visceral reaction that people attach to it. But we're living, the question is for all of you, what does marriage mean? And who do you want to define it? Do you want to put this definition in the state constitution? Or do you want to leave it to legislative process, community decision making, and so forth?
Oh, there's a couple other questions, but just to add one point, which is sort of an unspoken elephant, and that's religion. And obviously the definition in this little amendment has something to do with a particular kind of religion, or at least practice of a particular kind of religion. And of course, it's sort of interesting that your student wants the till death do us part when we know that means absolutely nothing. Heterosexual marriage. So, you know, it's just an irony, as also an old-time feminist. Anyway. Yeah.
I pass the microphone off quickly, but I would like to add one thing, and that is I think that for my partner and I, who actually on October 15th, we'll celebrate our sixth anniversary of having our commitment ceremony in this room, in this building. It was the recognition of our relationship by family, by friends, and it would be nice if the state would recognize it. There's just a lot of tradition, and we're fairly traditional. and I think a lot of other people, a lot of other gay and lesbian folks are very traditional, and it's important to have that recognition.
So, Jane.
I have a question about common law marriage. We've talked about marriage, that everybody understands. We've talked about civil unions, which would be just legal. it seems to me that there have been lots of unmarried people who, when they finally broke up, in fact, the woman had some more rights because she'd been with him so long, and so it was a common law marriage.
The question is, what is common law marriage, and how is that affected by this proposed amendment?
It would be done away with. Yeah.
What technically is common law marriage?
We believe that common law marriage would be invalid. Common law marriages would no longer be valid under the second paragraph of the amendment.
How do they work now?
Do you know? Common law marriage is where two individuals tell people that they are a couple. They act like a couple. They are indeed a couple. In fact, they may even refer to their husband or wife when there isn't a legal license issued by the state. And so over a certain number of years in states that have common law marriage, you simply become married, whether you actually go through the ceremony or not. It just becomes automatic after a certain time period. And the legal opinion here that I brought with me indicates that common law marriage would not be enforceable or any of the rights that people might think they have under it, even from other states.
David, you were good.
Common law marriage is not recognized in the common law. That issue is really a lot here, but there is an issue that there are states that recognize it, and whether people, if people were in Virginia or common law married in Texas, what would happen then? And I think that union probably wouldn't be recognized.
Yes.
Something I haven't heard a whole lot about is the way that this amendment will affect contracts, legal contracts between, say, other family members. Sons, fathers, daughters, parents, nephews, whatever. Because and in particular about marriage is the cornerstone of marriage is the joint ownership prior to survivorship. Would this amendment basically kill that opportunity? One, doesn't exist right now. Even as the laws are right now, could I own property with my son with rights of survivorship? I don't know.
I think that indeed is one of the big questions, because if you read the amendment, subdivision shall not create or recognize a legal status for relationships of unmarried individuals that intends to approximate the design, quality, significance, or effects of marriage. So anything that is an effect of marriage, which would be right of survivorship, legal directives, those kinds of things, it could be argued that that would not be enforceable for anyone that wasn't a married couple.
Yes.
Could I just follow up on that briefly?
Yeah.
Terry, if I were the judge, I would say that the contract between you and Ben, that the deed that the two of you buy with, is absolutely fine, that this amendment does not do away with or doesn't prohibit you or invalidate such an arrangement. The problem is we have no idea. I mean, I'm saying if I'm the judge, mm-hmm. I have no idea. We don't know what judges, in fact, will do. And a lot of the questions that we have, of course, depend on the prospect of litigation really being brought. Mm-hmm. If you and Ben enter into that agreement, I'm thinking Bev or Devin might decide to sue, you know, to try to break up the, you know. So we have to imagine lawsuits actually being brought. But, of course, lawsuits are stranger than fiction. People do sue, particularly when there are property arrangements mm-hmm. involved. So, yes, somebody somewhere will bring litigation and we're going to have to wait and see what judges say. Again, because of the way I read the amendment and what I read the core purpose to be, you know, and I made that clear, if I were the judge, I would just say, look, the definition of marriage, it's true that marriage includes joint property rights, but that's not, this amendment wasn't designed to do away with other, but who knows? We have no idea.
Let's take one slight step outside the panel. I'm friends with Mark, the neighbors,
right.
his partner, and I occasionally talk business things. And what if Ken and I were to say, let's buy that house together, and we'll have this joint ownership with rights of survivorship. Is that still in the same ballpark?
I think it could be vulnerable to attack on potentially the same grounds. But again, you know, there's going to have to be a plausible argument made that the contract is one that's designed to create the rights, benefits, obligations, qualities, or effects of marriage, right?
I think we are seeking to put too much under the umbrella of marriage. I recognize, of course, that that's only two categories in the wider sense, marriage and not marriage. However, it does seem to me that we have to notice what the intentionality is. That's the intent behind this by the proponents. Yes. And of course, as mentioned, it really has to do with the fact that we don't want gay people to have their rights. I recall in California some years ago when the AIDS virus came out, and I can't prove it, and a lot of people said that first of all it was manufactured, whether you accept that or not, in the laboratories to deal with AIDS, other than the gays. If we can wipe out the gays through something like that. Now that may not be true, but the fact is, what is true, that there was an effort to really do away with gay people. Of course, in California, San Francisco, it was a big thing at that time, and others were still in the closet. Some of those were out of the closet. And what happened, though, that AIDS thing became a Frankenstein. Once it was let out and began taking a lot of people, and still taking in people, who straight, crooked, and all other kinds of terms were used. So what I'm saying is, I think we have to be aware that it is design primarily that. But a lot of other things and a lot of other people want to be affected. So I would say that. So it seems to me that I think that we should be very much aware that we ought to be saying that everyone in this country, including illegal, in quote, immigrants, have a right to constitutional law. That's why we ought to be standing.
My concern is very practical, and I'm sure it's shared with the representative David, because he's a delegate. And this is for anything that ends up on the ballot. Seems like if it's your amendment or your issue, you get to name it euphemistically. And so this is the marriage called the marriage amendment, and there's things called the death tax. So how, you know, Marshall Newman, I'm sorry, but that doesn't, you know, gender strength of feelings about something. So how do we get past that? If the Democrats don't propose it, they don't get to name it. They don't think to publicize it, and it's harder to defeat, I think.
Well, I'm going to call it the Civil Rights Amendment.
Well, I know, but the point is, we're way past that point, and it's on the November ballot, and it's already been discussed in two, you know, sessions in the General Assembly. So, how do we deal with that? So, that's a practical issue, but I'm thinking one related to the effectiveness of it in
Well, I wasn't there the first session that it was passed, so I don't know all the machinations about that.
No, but I just think in general, you propose it, you get to provide the euphemistic name for it. That's how it's marketed, because it is marketed, and then it's harder to rename.
I heard a story about that the other day, and probably you've heard versions of this, that someone from Equality Virginia was lobbying in the citizenry and was doing phone banking, asked a woman about this amendment and what she thought of it, and she said somehow the phrase gay marriage amendment was in there. The woman said, after all the discussion, she said, "I'm against gay marriage, so I'm voting no." But along with that, and to expand on the question about contractual rights, is it conceivable that in the litigation purgatory that would follow if this thing is passed, suppose I wanted to make a contract with a friend of my gender, and the contract would include survivor rights. And it turns out that one of us is gay. Would that actually, in a court fight, be asked? And would that become a part of the argument of either side, that we would be cross-examined as to our sexual nature and also our sexual relationship with each other. And would that be a defining element in contextualizing this in the court?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, again, I agree with the comment that this gentleman made here, that the word, you know, that the meaning of the amendment is going to be tied in part to how we define marriage and what we think that the drafters aimed to get at. And Terry's examples, you know, with a child or with a neighbor, and now you're imagining, I take it, with a close friend, mm-hmm. you know, you're moving. I mean, again, what are the qualities?
It wouldn't even have to be a close friend.
No.
It could be a business associate.
Right.
But
right.
would the question
right.
of sexual nature
yeah.
be part of the legal comeback?
Well, I guess so. But now you're moving the ball, as far as I'm concerned, because I've been waiting for somebody to say. I mean, I'm a Catholic, so this is, you know, this is what I was told when I was a child, is that marriage is all about sex.
That's right.
You
the
know,
husband's
and,
wife, to, it's the husband's right to sex
yeah,
on demand.
It's all about sex. You got to wait till then, and there's
right.
no other reason to get married. So
that's right.
you know,
no, it's to have children. To have
right,
children.
Right, children. Forgot about
right.
those. Right. But that's exactly right. So you would imagine that the mm-hmm. that the ugliest litigation would involve somebody who's trying to undo your contractual right, who
mm-hmm.
maybe is trying to get access to property that you had disposed of otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And they are definitely going to be digging into sex life and sex practices to the extent that we think that that's what the umbrella of marriage includes.
Mm-hmm.
You could. Let me modify, or let me add one other thing, because we seem to be kind of focusing on one aspect. The other aspect is the reality of the Miller-Jenkins case, which is currently in process in Virginia. The Miller-Jenkins case is a lesbian couple, who went through a civil union ceremony in Vermont, if you remember, and one of them moved back to Virginia. Got Liberty Counsel behind them, claimed she was no longer a lesbian, and challenged the custody order that was issued by the Vermont court. The judge in Virginia used House Bill 751, saying we don't recognize civil unions, therefore we cannot and do not recognize custody orders mm-hmm. from the state of Vermont, and has denied custody to one of the moms in the case. It's a major federal issue. It actually runs afoul of federal legislation as well as state legislation that we don't allow parents in divorce cases to forum shop. We don't allow people to grab kids and run to another state where they think they can get a better deal once a final order has been issued. The Vermont court has held the woman that lives in Virginia in contempt. The Virginia court has said the woman in Vermont has no parental rights, and so it's now moving through the courts. But it's a very real case involving real people and, unfortunately, a child.
Yes.
I see this amendment as a part of a nationwide political movement by a small but loud group who intend to impose their religious tenets on the rest of the world. And I'm wondering if any of our panelists know how much influence ALEC had in the writing of this amendment, because it sounds very much like what's been passed in 21 other states, and other state constitutions have been similarly amended.
Could you tell us what ALEC is?
Yes, it's the American Legislative Exchange Council. And it's what little bit I know about it, because they're very secretive about who belongs to it, although I believe that there are some Virginia legislators who do belong, since we paid for them to attend a conference with state money. And their sessions are generally closed to the public and the press. But what they do is come up with model language for various types of legislation. And if you compare this wording to other amendments to other state constitutions, you'll find a great deal of similarity, which I think, directly relates to the vagueness of the second paragraph.
Clearly the language is similar, so similar, that absent some alien force connecting people, there's an entity behind the wording.
Actually, was David here when the question was asked? David, do you know if any of the legislators who supported this are members of something called ALEC, the American
Legislative Exchange Council?
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me, but I don't know.
You said this was language in 21 states? There are 21 other states whose constitutions have already been amended.
Ooh.
With these kinds of amendments.
So 21?
It's different wording. A number of the other states simply stopped with the first sentence, but Ohio passed one almost identical to the one that's being proposed here.
I was very interested to read Judge Wilkinson's op-ed piece, and I assume all of you have read it as well. And I saw some echoes of his views that I took to mean that we don't want a constitutional amendment in large part because it just forbids the political process from working itself on issues of these great sensitivities and political importance. I wonder how you all feel about that. It seems to me today that the major effort of trying to persuade me to support it, or to oppose it, which I already do anyway, is highly legalistic and based on none of the main issues of the political process, but rather legal uncertainty related to people who are not necessarily gay or who are gay and who might have normal civil relations. I'd like to ask you, why don't we emphasize Judge Wilkinson's view more as a major orientation to try and persuade those who are not inclined to vote against it?
There have been efforts to use to talk about the fact that this is the kind of legislation that should be dealt with in the laws and not constitutionally. The argument that the Family Foundation makes and others like them is that we can't trust all those activist judges. And if you make it a constitutional amendment, then it's protected. Of course, here's the irony. Then the only people who can interpret it are judges. And that's, you know, so when we say that to people, they go, oh, I didn't even know, because people are completely ignorant about what happens when something becomes a part of the Constitution. Then we have no say in it whatsoever, but judges have a lot of say. So, so what I've said to people about that, and I haven't had too many people come back at me with this activist judge thing, because they're all frightened we'll become Massachusetts, which is, you know, when will that happen? I wish. Anyway, so the idea that judges in Virginia are appointed by the General Assembly, and I just can't imagine. Well, the judge in the Miller-Jenkins case really knew better, but he made that decision because he knew full well he wouldn't have a job in a couple of years if he did the right thing. So, in fact, we don't have activist judges.
It's interesting to me that you find that to be the most appealing argument. I agree with you completely. I mean, that's the one that always persuades me as a voter. I just look at these and say, no, we're not going to put this in the Constitution. Let the political process deal with it. And again, good for Judge Wilkinson. He and I probably don't agree on very many things in terms of political, you know, underlying politics. But in terms of the process, I think he's got it exactly right. I think the fear is that argument won't be sufficiently appealing to a broad enough group. Again, people who are inclined to look at it and think, yeah, hey, no problem, I want to enshrine this view in the Constitution.
I wonder if the prohibition amendment is any kind of precedent for this, that it's just a contraction of rights in the name of social good as defined by the forerunners of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, perhaps, and who then enjoined the whole populace, which gave rise to many other social effects and social ills, and quite possibly resulted in some ways in President Kennedy. So, would that be also a precedent that could be suggested?
Yeah, it could be, and I think that's a lovely example. If you think about the very short life of the Prohibition Amendment, it was passed in a very powerful reformist movement. Very vocal groups, as some of you have said about this, got on board, and there was a movement made that ends up again failing very, very quickly. And I think that one thing to think about these days too is the very short period of time between Bowers versus Hardwick and Lawrence versus Texas. You know, Bowers versus Hardwick in 86, the Supreme Court upholds the rights of the states to criminalize sodomy, and then lo and behold, less than 20 years later, a very conservative court reverses itself. So within a tiny, tiny span of time in terms of our constitutional history, Supreme Court justices, who are conservative people to begin with anyway, always, and these are particularly conservative, they flipped on this issue. So again, there's just no doubt whatsoever that this is an issue that's, you know, subject to a lot of ongoing debate, and we're likely to see some change.
That gentleman in the back.
The issue of religion has been mentioned here several times, and obviously there's a huge religious animus and energy in back of those who are in favor of this amendment. And one can respond one of two ways. One is simply to invoke rights against what you view as religious restraint. And we've heard some of that here. But the other is to turn it against the religious group by appealing to what has been there in the religious tradition. I've heard it mentioned here twice. Once in that statement, what draws me is the notion until death do us part. Well, that is suggesting that you're just not talking about rights simply to do as you please, but you recognize that what you want in the fulfillment of your freedom is the possibility of fidelity in sexual and intimate relations. That's what that phrase, until death do us part, is talking about, and that is there in the religious tradition. So it's not just religion is the enemy, but one has to talk about what is the content of the religious aspiration. And the other point that I've heard here is this notion that one naturally would like full public recognition. And that was there in the whole sense of dynamics of movement from courtship to marriage. Courtship is a withdrawal from the world. Two's company, three's a crowd. A woman wants to get out of the world. Marriage is that state where, still nourished by the intimacy of your relationship, you want to turn outward towards the world and with the kind of recognition and support that can only be given to you in the sense of the ceremony. So I think we cut short what is available to us by way of argument if we simply see it as liberty to do as you please versus religious restraint. There's a way of tapping into the religious tradition, not only in the West, but certainly in the West, of the aspiration towards fidelity and intimacy, and the desire to the sense that there's a natural consummation in public recognition. That was there in the marriage ceremony before God and these witnesses. It's turning out towards the public. I myself am an academic, but I am also ordained, and I'll never forget how funny I thought it was when I was asked to perform a ceremony down in Dallas in a place called Hondo's Hideaway. I mean, it was not a church, but, you know, it was just the opposite of what a marriage is all about. It's no longer hiding away, but opening out towards the public. Just as in architecture, we have the private rooms of intimacy in the house, the bathroom and the bedroom, but we also have the public rooms into which we open and welcome the world. And that's what people would like to see when they aspire to marriage.
Steve.
Just speaking to the strategic people, I think the perception is that you wouldn't spend like religious and not if I should. We didn't have a theologian on the panel that I feel like we should have. I think we should have very publicly the religious debate. Okay, because to me, the religious tradition clearly says this is the wrong way to treat our neighbor. This is the wrong way to treat our brother. And the religious message needs to be as part of the faith values.
Certainly, just along those lines, there are members of the coalition that are representing different faith groups, and there are several Virginians of faith, that isn't quite the name, it'll come to me, are working from that perspective as well, working with churches.
I will mention, by the way, and I feel this myself as an absence, Dave Segarin, who organized this panel, did try to find someone in support of the bill. I think it would have been very useful for us to hear would be, I suppose, a reasoned argument in support of this, because I don't think, I don't have a basis for making it, and I don't think we've heard that today. It would, in another way, just as these last two comments have quite wonderfully, I think, enlarged the discussion, we would know more. Yes.
I just wanted to remark, in discussions of potential legal consequences of passage of this, if this passes, it's always being talked about as the adults who are potential same-sex couples being the litigants. In fact, this Miller versus Jenkins is the adults are litigating. But Miller versus Jenkins involves children. And it strikes me that the children are potential litigants as well, and that could lead to a political movement in the years to come. Is there any sign that that's happened yet?
A political movement of what sort?
Look, the children are being harmed by things like this proposed amendment. They're going to be harmed. That's pretty clear. If their parents do not have proper legal rights, that has consequences on the children. And the children are, I think, they have a cause of action. As a lawyer, Freddie's would have it. Am I right?
Certainly, in situations, I don't know of any that's happened at this point, but mm-hmm. certainly it's conceivable that children would have the right to vocalize in situations that were hurting them economically or psychologically, those sorts of things. But typically that's done in more of a custody issue, divorce issue.
I'm speaking of a constitutional matter. That is there a potential constitutional suit to be brought by children, not just same-sex yeah. couples?
Well, it seems to me that children of any couple, unmarried couple, would have grounds. But, I mean, something that comes to my mind right away are the children of gay and lesbian employees at the University of Virginia, where the birth parent, if there is a birth parent, because sometimes we're adoptive, but if the birth parent is not the employee, the children nor the birth parent have health insurance because the university does not provide health insurance to domestic partners, and therefore the children are also not covered. And so there's a good lawsuit right there.
Yes, great lawsuit.
Thank you for that idea, because we have a number of children.
We have argued that they're being discriminated.
That's right.
Because of the sexual orientation.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that idea.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Okay. Just
we're on it.
Yeah.
When I was reading through this amendment, it struck me that by its wording, you have precisely the same set of contracts or contractual relationships, and if the one was ought to have an intent of approximating marriage, it would not be allowed. And if the other one just said, well, we're not intending to approximate marriage, how do you evaluate it?
Actually, that's the question Uriah asked before, raised before, too. It's the question of intention, intent, right? And that also was about my question. You know, would this come out in a court matter? Then the intention is biased to prevent a union of any sort between.
Yeah, but I'm saying that if you have exactly the same kinds of circumstances,
right,
precisely the same kinds of acts, and you're saying the only thing that makes it illegal is intent, then how do you determine
intent?
The judges do.
You just do all your contracts, do exactly the same thing, but we don't intend this to be like marriage.
Right. Right. Well, the problem, though, is the last sentence seems to try to put a stake in the heart of that argument. But I agree with you. It's very hard to know what either of those sentences means. But the second one, of course, says that the Commonwealth shall not recognize unions to which is assigned the rights, quite apart from intent. Mm-hmm.
One thing that judges do look at is they look at the reality, not what you say. And typically that's in the area of tax law and everything else. If it walks like, looks like, squawks like a duck, it probably is, no matter what you say in the contract or no matter what you say to the tax authorities. So with that history, judges certainly look behind the words to look at what the actions indicate.
Mm-hmm. I hate to say this, but we are only in here till 11. So let me take one more question, sir.
Okay. My question is... what about adopted children, such as Asian, South American? These are children that people with good hearts decided to adopt, and not necessarily married, not necessarily, they may even be single parents. What happens to those children's rights? They're kids, they're growing up as American citizens.
Currently, joint adoption is not available in Virginia for same-sex couples, and I believe, I'm not sure about unmarried couples. Hmm. Unmarried couples, it's my understanding, cannot have a joint adoption, so the adoption would be only by one parent.
Which is the situation my partner...
But his question goes farther than that. I have three friends who are single women who have adopted children. And I think he's asking if what they're...
The arrangement between the two of them, mm-hmm. whether that's prohibited. That's
right. I mean...
Well, but the question would be, this goes back to the intent question, because right. I'm sure some of you, I mean, you must be aware of old arrangements in... there are cases on the books where... A gay couple would adopt the other in order to create family rights. Now, obviously, what you're saying here is very different. The parent, in fact, is adopting the child to be a parent-child relationship. But the question would be whether mm-hmm. these same arguments could be, it's possible.
And or even to bring it more currently, if I were to adopt a troubled girl under legal age. Presumably there would be questions. There would be social questions about that. There would be many questions, right? But one surely would be under this is whether that was a contractual relationship that intended to have the benefits of a marital union. I know we can go further with this. This is a huge, troubling matter moving out in all directions. But I'll have to bring it to a close. Mark wants to add one. Yeah.
If I can say one more thing, I would be in trouble if I didn't. There's need for help on this issue. Obviously, there's also need for money. I wanted to let you know that any money that's contributed to the Commonwealth Coalition from this point forward goes to the media budget. All other expenses have already been carried. I've already been taken care of. In fact, there's already a chunk of money in the media budget. But any contributions go toward getting the message directly to the voters at this point.
Is that in addition to this box? I mean,
this is for breakfast.
That's just for breakfast.
Yeah.
In the room.
Right.
And the room.
Right.
And the answer, Dan.
Well, thank you all very much for coming.
If I may.